It's a pleasure to visit here again. I think I was here 3 years ago. I hope to come more often in the future. So I'm going to talk today about the reformulation of quantum mechanics, which is using, instead of the usual formulation, two vectors in Hilbert space instead of one, describing a quantum system at any moment of time. I came to this reformulation by trying to understand the most surprising thing that quantum mechanics revealed about nature, and that is the fact that two quantum systems that start exactly in the same state behave differently in the future. You have two atoms that are excited, they're in the same state, in the same environment. One of them decays after 1 minute and the other after 1 hour for no reason at all. And that was very, very shocking because it seems that nature behaves in a capricious way. Why should two things that are exactly the same behave differently in the future? It goes so much against all the ideas of science that everything that happens in the future needs to have some cause in the present. And indeed, Einstein was one of the developers of quantum mechanics, and Mond was, of course, perhaps the greatest physicist ever, was very unhappy about quantum mechanics because of that. And he said that he doesn't believe that God plays dice. Namely, he doesn't believe that for random reasons, two things behave differently, even though they were the same at the beginning. I was led in my research to try to understand why nature behaved this way, so I reformulated or rephrased what Einstein said, and I asked the question, why does God play dice? Namely, what does nature gain, apparently, from this uncertainty? And indeed, in this talk, I will show you that this kind of consideration led me to a new way to think about quantum uncertainties. And the idea is the following. If you have two things that behave differently in the future, perhaps nature is trying to tell us that the future is also relevant to explain what happens in the present, not only the past, but also the future. And I will show you that it's possible to reformulate quantum mechanics and saying that the present is influenced not only by things that were done in the past to the system, but also by things that will be done to the future, to the system in the future. At first, this looks as it goes against the idea of causality or the idea that we have free will, because if we can decide after the present to change our mind and to do a different experiment in the future, how is it possible that the present will be changed because of that? So I will show that the quantum uncertainties are exactly the things that are necessary in order to make a possibility for the future to affect the present without violating causality or without violating the principle that we have a freedom to decide which experiment we are going to do in the future. So this is the idea of this talk. I'm going to show you that because of the uncertainty principle, it's possible to show that nature behaves in a way that the future is also relevant for what happened in the present. So let us start with considering something that is named exclusive experiments, in which you can show that you can put also boundary conditions in the future. An example for that kind of experiment, where is the chalk? Oh, here. Is the following. Suppose I have a cloud chamber. This is a chamber that has the property that if you send the particle in, it will leave some tracks here by bubbles. And then the particle will go out. And I send one particle after the other. All of them are in the same initial state. Some of them will come in this direction, others will come in another direction. I can put the counter here. And I can do the following. I will take pictures of all the tracks, but later I will look only at the tracks that were left by particles that started to move in this direction and ended up by coming to this counter. So this is a pre-selection and the post-selection. I don't consider the whole ensemble. I consider only a sub-ensemble of particles that all of them started in the same state initially, and all of them ended in the same state finally, those that went in this direction. Now, this is an experiment that could not be done classically, because in classical theory, if I start with two particles that have exactly the same classical initial state, they will all go in exactly the same line with exactly the same velocity, and therefore they will all end up in the same counter. So only quantum mechanically I have the option or the freedom, because of the uncertainty principle, to do a pre-selection and a post-selection. And this is what I'm going to discuss in the whole talk. What happens to quantum systems that I have done on them pre-selection and post-selection? What new properties are revealed for some quantum systems? So let's look what is the formalism trying to tell us about such an experiment. Here is time. At time t1, I start with particles or quantum systems that are all described initially by the same state, psi1. At time t2, I do a post-selection. I consider out of this whole ensemble only the sub-ensemble that ended up in the state psi2. And now I ask, if I do this pre-selection and post-selection, what can I say about experiments that are done in the time in between? So this is the past, this is the future, and this is the present. I'm discussing properties of experiments that are done in the present, given the information that I'm not only selecting psi1, but also selecting only those that ended up at psi2. So suppose I make a measurement here of some observable that is described by an Hermitian operator A. This observable has the property that has a complete set of eigenvectors alpha n, suppose it's discrete observable, with the eigenvalues alpha n times the state alpha n. And I'm asking now, what is the probability, if I make this measurement in the middle, what is the probability to get a particular state alpha m? So I do an experiment here, get for a particular particle the result alpha m, and I'm asking now, what is the probability to start with psi1, to get the value alpha m, and to end up in the state psi2? The usual formalism that uses just one vector says the following. I start with psi1. I evolve it in time by the time evolution operator from t1 to the time t, where u is equal to e to the minus I, the Hamiltonian times the time, u of t, or the time difference in this case. Then I got the answer here, alpha m, so the amplitude to get this is alpha m times u times psi1. Then I start now with alpha m. So here I had the evolution of psi1 as a function of t from the initial time until the present. From now on, I have a new state, which is alpha m, that evolves as a function of time from the intermediate time until the final time. And then I project it on psi2. Forgot the time evolution again. I evolve the state alpha m by u of t up to t2, and then I project it from the state psi2. And if I call this an amplitude cm, cm absolute value square is equal to the probability to get the state, the answer m in the middle, alpha m in the middle, under the condition that I started with psi1 and ended at psi2. If I add all the cm absolute value square, I don't get 1, because I take only a sub-ensemble, right? It's an exclusive experiment. I exclude all the particles that end up in another state. So the sum of the absolute value of cm square is smaller than 1, so if I take cm square, absolute value square, and divide by the sum of Cn, absolute value square, the sum over n, this gives me now the probability to get alpha m under the condition that I'm looking now at the sub-ensemble Well, I divided by the probability to get psi to at the end. Now I do something that looks extremely trivial mathematically, but it will lead to a completely new picture. I take this thing that I calculated there, which was psi 2 u alpha m u psi 1. This is u from t1 to t, and this is u from t to t2. And I bring this u here. And I say I will calculate the same thing by using here u dagger times psi 2 alpha m u times psi 1. Now, u dagger is the evolution by using a time backward, because if I look at u and I write it e to the minus ihc, then u dagger is equal to e to the plus ihc, but it can be written also e to the minus ih times minus c. So u dagger is the time evolution going backwards in time. So this new picture tells me that I can get exactly the correct answer, exactly the same prediction as quantum mechanics tells me, but I use a new picture. The new picture is, if this is time, I now start with the state psi 1, evolve it in time up to the middle, I end up with the state psi 2 and evolve it backwards in time, like a bra, I evolve it in backwards in time up to here, and I calculate using both vectors of equal footing, I calculate the answer to the probability to get anything that I like in the middle. Since I get exactly the same prediction as quantum mechanics, I'm allowed to use this picture. And the question is whether this picture is going to be useful to uncover new properties of quantum systems between the time of pre and post selection that would otherwise be completely hidden, and that's the reason why it wasn't discovered. All these properties I'm going to tell you now, it's a host of new phenomena that was not seen because we were thinking just in the one vector formalism. So you will see how rich is the new phenomena once we think in this new way. So I repeat, we get exactly the same answer as the one vector formalism. So predictions are exactly the same, but a new concept, a new type of ideas come if we describe a system with two vectors. First of all, I can already point to one advantage of the two vectors compared to the one, and that is the fact that the calculation of what happened in the middle is much simpler if I use the two vectors instead of one. Because if I use one vector, for each new result here, I have to solve another differential equation and evolve it from here to here. So for each different experiment, each different answer, I have to solve another differential equation. On the other hand, if I use these two vectors, once and for all, I calculate psi 1 of t and psi 2 of t, just two differential equations, and then from then on, the answer to every experiment that I do here is just a scalar product. It's just a scalar product of this times the result here and this times the result here. So this is much, much simpler. It's a normal simplification for calculation. But if that was the only thing, I would not have spent your time. I want now to show to you that there is something much more exciting that happens when you start to think about quantum mechanics this way. I don't like the fact that when I erase it, there is so much dirt that's left on the blackboard. I don't know what to do with it. Maybe it's because they are so dirty. The erasers. By the way, are there any questions so far? I encourage you to ask questions, otherwise I will be bored here. No questions? Yes, please.
Field theory.
Yes.
You use a path integral formalism.
The what?
The path integral formalism, the action, the principle. There you need to know the initial and final boundary conditions.
I can't hear you well. I don't know why. Okay.
In quantum field theory,
yes.
We use the path integral method, Feynman's path integral, the action principle. And there you have to know the initial and final conditions for scattering of particles, for example.
So you
need to know the future as well as the past.
Lucille, can you say to me more clearly what he's asking?
I'm not sure. In quantum field theory, you use the path integral approach, and you need to know the initial and final conditions there also.
Yeah, it's true. If you use the Feynman formalism, then indeed, you put a precondition, a path condition, so as far as this is concerned, there seems to be no difference. But when you start to think about the two vectors, you will see in a minute that I come to new ideas that would be difficult to see in the other way, okay? So the Feynman formula is just another way to calculate the same thing. I showed that I can calculate it in two different ways. I do pre and post relation, I can calculate the probability to get any answer in the middle, either by using the one vector or by using the Feynman formalism. It gives me all the correct answers. There are three ways to get the correct answer. The usual one vector formulation, the Feynman formalism, which is equivalent, and this new way. The question is whether the new way gives you something new to think about, because once you think that these two vectors exist there, even if you don't do the experiment, you can start to ask now what is the new properties of such system. As you will see, there is advantage to start this way. But you are right, I can calculate things, of course, using the Feynman formalism. I've shown that I can calculate correctly using one vector. So one vector and the Feynman formalism are equivalent to each other. Okay. So I'll start with the first new idea. Suppose I have the simplest quantum system. I start with a spin half system that initially is in the state sigma is equal to plus 1 using the Pauli normalization. That's a time t1. And at time t2, I postulate out of this ensemble of particles only those that ended up in the state sigma y is equal to plus 1. So I have n particles, all of them starting in the state sigma is equal to plus 1, and I postulate only half of them, approximately, that ended up in the state sigma y equal to plus 1. Now, in the usual formalism, I say, look, these particles were all described by the state sigma is equal to plus 1, and from now on, they will be replaced by sigma y equal to plus 1, and that's it. Now, if I take this picture seriously, I say, no, actually, all the particles will be described by two vectors. One vector is going this way, with sigma x equal to plus 1. I like to call it the history vector. And another vector, which is the destiny vector, is the vector that comes this way, and this is the state sigma y equal to plus 1, which is a bra because it's going backwards in time, and I have the state sigma x equal to plus 1, which is that state coming this way. If I take seriously this picture, I say, look, these particles that I pre and post selected have two properties instead of one. Always in the time in between, they have the property sigma x equal to plus 1 and sigma y equal to plus 1. Can I find an experiment that will show me that both of them really existed there in the middle? Now, which experiment can I do? I can do a trivial experiment that is not interesting at all. If I measure sigma x only on these particles, obviously on all of them I will get sigma x equal to plus 1 because that's how I started. If I measure sigma y equal to plus 1, indeed only for half of them I will get plus 1, but by fiat, I actually decided only to keep those. And therefore, it's not interesting that I would get sigma y equal to plus 1 for this, because those are the only ones that I decided to keep. So it's trivial, it's not interesting that I say that for this kind of particle, both sigma x equal to plus 1 and sigma y equal to plus 1. But when I thought about it, I asked myself, what will happen if I will measure sigma x plus sigma y? Just a single experiment. If this is equal to 1 and this is equal to 1, I told myself, okay, I should get here the answer 2. But then immediately I realized that cannot happen. Because if I look at sigma x plus sigma y divided by square root of 2, I cannot get here the value square root of 2 because sigma h plus sigma y divided by square root of 2 is just a spin component in 45 degrees, and therefore it can be only plus 1 or minus 1, never square root of 2. So I got discouraged. I said, okay, that picture leads me astray. But after a while, I decided not to give up. And I asked myself, why don't I get the value 2 or square root of 2 in this normalization? And I realized that the reason is that if I do an experiment in the mirror to measure sigma x plus sigma y, I have to use for this experiment a magnetic field or inhomogeneous magnetic field in the x plus y direction, like in Stern-Gerlach experiment. Such a magnetic field will make sigma x precess and sigma y precess, and therefore they will not remain the same. So if I do this experiment in mirror, it takes some finite time, I disturb both vectors. I disturb the vectors to come from here, I disturb the vectors that come from here, and therefore I cannot expect it to be equal to 2 because my experiment exactly destroys what I'm trying to measure. So when I realized this, I said maybe I can find an experiment that will be gentle enough, eventually I call it weak measurement, that will be such that will give me some information without disturbing these vectors at all. And under these conditions, I will be able to get the vector that the answer to. Now, it's usually believed that if you want to get some information about the quantum system, you must disturb it. So here I'm saying, look, I want to finally get a situation where I don't disturb the system and I still get information. And I discovered that there is a very interesting limit in quantum mechanics where you can actually do an experiment that interacts very weakly with each one of the particles. In fact, so weakly that you can show that none of them is disturbed, and nevertheless you find information about them. This is a new kind of limit that people did not realize that solves this. When you have an ensemble of particles, you can find all the properties of this ensemble without disturbing even a single particle. So Bohr was wrong in saying that you always have to, when you speak about quantum system, you always have to realize that the properties of this quantum system is dictated not only by what there is really there, but also by what experimental setup you are doing, you are putting on it, because it's just as much a property of the system to know not only how it was prepared, but also which experiment you are doing, because experiments in quantum theory necessarily have to disturb the system. This is not true. In order to check the properties of quantum systems, you always have to use ensemble, because otherwise you can't get probabilities. And in fact, you can show that when you have an ensemble, you can do measurements that find all the properties of this ensemble without disturbing even a single particle. Let me prove it to you that this can be done. Suppose that somebody prepares n spin half particles that don't interact with each other for simplicity, and it prepares all of them in the same direction. All the spins are pointing in the same direction, and you have a large number of them. So large that if you look at the scalar product of all of them prepared in one direction and all of them prepared in slightly different directions, the scalar product of the first ensemble with the second ensemble goes to zero as cosine of the angle between them divided by n. So if n is sufficiently large, the direction, one direction and another direction are orthogonal to each other. So in principle, it's possible to find in which direction all of these spins were prepared. The question is, which experiment can I do, if I don't know in which direction they were prepared, which experiment can I do to find out the direction? The trivial experiment that everybody would consider, which is the usual way of doing it, would be to say the following. Look, I choose a subset of them and measure all of them sigma x for the first, sigma x for the second, etc. And I will get sometimes plus one, sometimes minus one. I will calculate from this the average of sigma x for this subset. Then I choose another subset and do the same for sigma y. And up to, I have now really the spin direction up to one possibility, so I will measure also the sum of sigma z for a third set. That will give me the limit of large n, indeed, the the wave function of the ensemble, and that's the usual type of experiment that people consider. For example, if you have psi of x for all of them, the way to find psi star of x, psi x, is to make the measurements of x and see how many times you get one value, how many times you get another value. This is the way how measurements of ensemble usually are considered quantum mechanically. These are disturbing experiments. They include collapses of the system. And I want now to show there is another experiment that doesn't include collapse at all, doesn't do any disturbance at all, and nevertheless find the wave function for the system. And the way to do it is to do the following. If you look at the operator, sum of sigma xn divided by n. This is an operator, it's an omission operator, which is an operator for the whole system. And you look at the operator, sum of sigma yn divided by n, and the third operator, sum of sigma zn divided by n, the commutation relation between any two of those goes to zero when n goes to infinity, because the commutator of sigma xn with sigma yn is I sigma zn. You have an n square on the bottom and only the sum of sigma z at the top. So those three things commute with each other, and then you can measure the three of them. And in fact, that gives you sigma x average, sigma y average, and sigma z average, which gives us the direction of the spin of each one of them. And then the limit when n goes to infinity, no disturbance at all. Now I want to prove a general theorem. The general theorem is the following. If you have an ensemble, psi total is the wave function, the vector for the ensemble, which is the product over n, going from 1 over n, where n is the total number of particles, of individual vector psi n. So I have n particles that are all described in the same state. I want now to prove that if you look at the operator, a sum of a n divided by n, where a n are operators for individual system, that sum times psi total is equal to a average, the average of a for a single particle, times psi total plus delta psi, where delta psi goes to zero is 1 over n, or delta psi absolute value square go to zero is 1 over n. That means that if you measure this operator, you find exactly its average value for a single particle without disturbing even a single particle. So for example, if I look at psi x, and if the operator that I choose here is a projection operator on a particular small region of space, the average of this operator, when I measure it, will give me exactly what psi star psi of x without disturbing even a single particle of the ensemble. No questions so far? Any questions? Everything is clear? Unbelievable. What? All right. So let me prove it by using, first of all, the following formula. If I look at an operator A acting on a vector psi in any Hilbert space, then I want to show that this is equal, I first of all know this is equal to A1 times psi itself plus A2 times an orthogonal state of psi. This is a general theorem in vector space. A times psi gives me a new vector. I can take this new vector and ask what amplitude it has on the same vector and what amplitude it has on the orthogonal vector. And I can always choose the psi phase of this for A2 to be real. Now, it's a very nice formula because A1 and A2 have very interesting properties. I can show that A1 is equal to the average of A, and A2 is equal to the uncertainty of A. But now, these two quantities will be these two quantities will be not statistical quantities because they're properties of an individual system. They are geometrical properties. How do I prove it? By the way, is this formula known to anyone here? Because I'm very surprised that I did not see it in books. It's such a nice general formula. General formula in Hilbert space is so beautiful. Now, let me prove it to you. If I take A psi and I multiply it by psi, I get this the so-called A average, but now it's not an average. It's a geometrical property. It's a mathematical property. If I do it in this case, I multiply it by psi, because this is orthogonal, I get here A1. So this is equal to A1. So A1 is indeed the average of A. Now, suppose I multiply the vector by itself. So I take A psi and multiply it by A psi. Now, it brings the A here. So this is equal to psi times A squared times psi, because it's a emission operator, I can bring it here. So this is the average of A squared. On the other hand, if I look at this vector by itself, this is the product of the vector by itself, it's equal to A1 squared plus A2 squared. So this is equal to A average squared plus A2 squared. So A2 squared is equal to A squared, the average of A squared, minus the square of the average, and therefore delta A squared. So I've proven a general theorem then that if you take an operator A multiplied by any vector psi in Hilbert space, it's equal to the average of A, so-called average, but now it's a geometrical property, times psi, plus delta A times psi orthogonal. Okay, very nice formula. And indeed, it should be in every quantum theory book because it's such a beautiful formula. And it shows that we can interpret the so-called average of A and the uncertainty of A now as geometrical properties in Hilbert space, not a statistical property. Now, so if I look now, what happens when I take the sum of AN divided by N and multiply it by the product over N of the individual system psi N? This should be psi M. Okay, so now if I look at the particular term here, a particular AL over N, and I multiply the ensemble. Then AL acts only on particle L. It doesn't do anything to the other particle. And when it acts on particle L, it gives me two contributions. One of them is A average times the same state, plus delta A times an orthogonal state. So this will be equal to the same ensemble wave function, the same psi total for the ensemble, times the average, the individual single average divided by N, plus the uncertainty of A, times the new state, which I will call psi L for the ensemble, where psi L is the state where the whole ensemble is unaffected apart from particle L that went to an orthogonal state. So all these vectors are orthogonal to each other, because if I look at different L's, for one of them, one particle went to an orthogonal state, for another particle went to an orthogonal state. So these states are orthogonal to each other. So therefore, if I look at the sum of AL over N times the ensemble, I get here A average times psi total, because I have N contributions that are the same, plus the sum over L, which is this thing, the sum over L of these things. This is what I call delta psi. Now, delta psi times delta psi goes to 0 as 1 over N. Why? Because if I look at the product of this time itself, I get 1 over n squared here, and I get n contribution because these are orthogonal to each other. So I have delta A squared over n for the whole thing. It goes to 0 when n goes to infinity. Delta S is the uncertainty for an individual particle, so it doesn't depend on n. So therefore, indeed, I see that if I look at any ensemble made out of a large number of particles, and I measure the operator A, any operator, sum of n divided by n, that ensemble is an eigenstate of this operator with the eigenvalue A average times psi total. So I can measure all these operators. They commute with each other. I can measure all of them on an ensemble. If the ensemble is sufficiently big, I don't disturb even a single particle, and I find all the information about the individual state. So it's possible to check by this kind of weak measurement. Why weak? Because the interaction with each individual particle goes to 0 as 1 over n. I can check it exactly without disturbing the system at all. Now, what is the secret? Why does it work? Let me explain it by using the phonomial formalism for measurement. According to the phonomial formalism, if you measure an operator A for a quantum system, you can think about the measuring device as having a pointer that moves by an amount that depends on the eigenvalue of A. So you use a unitary transformation, which is e to the I q, where q is a coordinate for the measuring device, times A, the thing that you want to measure, times some coupling strength lambda. And this applies to the state of the system psi times the state of the measuring device phi. Now, if I look at the measuring device in the representation where the momentum conjugate to q is diagonalized, then this is a translation operator of this momentum depending on the value of A. So, for example, if psi is an eigenstate of A with an eigenvalue alpha, this will be e to the I lambda q times alpha, and this will act on the state phi. Here will be the state psi now that I can take outside if it's an eigenstate of A. And then this will translate the momentum of the particle by an amount proportional to lambda times alpha. So if this is the wave function for the pointer, psi of the pointer, phi of the pointer, which is a function of pq, this is the initial function. It will be translated by a distance, lambda times the eigenvalue. So I can look at the pointer and find out what is the value of A if the interaction is sufficiently strong. But now suppose I look at the limit where lambda is so small that the shift of this state is much smaller than the uncertainty. This is what I call the weak measurement limit. So suppose, for example, I normalize lambda in the following way. I look at e to the I lambda q times A, and I write lambda as lambda prime divided by n, where n is going to be the number of particles that this measuring device is going to interact with that are all in the same state. And I assume that lambda prime is finite, but larger than 1. But very small compared to n, because n will become very large. Then, under this condition, I can look at this operator and write it as equal to 1 plus I lambda qa, and neglect the higher order terms because this is lambda prime over n. And n is very large, so I can neglect the higher order terms. And now, if I look, what does it do to the state of a single particle? This thing, when I act on psi times phi, then using my theorem about A times psi, I remind you, A psi is equal to A average psi plus delta A times psi. So this will become 1 plus I. This is lambda prime here. 1 plus I lambda prime divided by n q times A average times psi times phi plus I lambda prime q over n times delta A times some orthogonal to psi, some state that's orthogonal to psi times phi. And now you can see what's happening here. When I do this weak measurement, this thing will be shifted by the average of A, and this thing will be negligible because the probability to find this state goes to zero as 1 over n squared. So this shows indeed that when you have any weak coupling, it can be a measurement or any weak coupling, and when it's sufficiently weak, that coupling will be proportional to the average of the state psi without disturbing psi at all, at the limit when you have a sufficiently weak coupling. So this is a general theorem for weak measurement. And now I come to the really new thing. Up to now, this is really the thing that you could have done with one vector, but it shows nevertheless something new, interesting, which is the fact that you can make measurements without disturbance. Now comes the really interesting thing. So suppose I have my n particles that I do this weak measurement on, and I think about the following thing. I have particle number 1, particle number 2, particle number 3. All of them are described by the same state. They can be different locations. And now I have a measuring device that has one coordinate, q, and its conjugate pq. It comes first and interacts with this one, then with that one, then et cetera. And finally, it shifts by an average over all of them. The question is now, by how much does it shift when it interacts with each one of them? And now the surprise comes, actually, by how much it shifts when it interacts with each one of them depends not only on the state in the past, but also on the state in the future. And let me prove it to you. This is the new thing that shows the relevance of the two vectors. So I will prove it to you in two steps. First of all, let us look at the formula for A average for a single particle, which is equal to psi A average psi. Now I do something trivial. I add a complete set of states, sum over n times psi, phi n, A psi. Since the sum over n of phi n is equal to units, I'm allowed to put it there. And now I do one extra step. I divide and multiply by the same thing, so I write here the sum over n, psi phi n, phi n psi, and I have here phi n a psi divided by phi n psi. Multiply and divide by the same thing. I assume that all of the states phi n are not orthogonal to psi. It's only a set of measure zero if one of them may be orthogonal to psi, so I neglect that thing. So this is a well-defined thing. And now look what happened. If I do a very weak measurement, then I know that the weak measurement doesn't change psi. Therefore, that thing here is the probability to start with psi and end up with phi n. And it's multiplied by a new thing, which I call A weak. So A weak is defined to be a property of an operator A when you have a preselection and postselection. So you have two states, for example, the state phi n and the operator A and the state psi, and you divide it by phi n psi. So I claim that these new numbers, which are property of an operator, when you have pre and post selection, are indeed the values that you will get for this operator when you do weak measurement. So there's a new kind of physical value that is connected with what happens when you have pre and post reaction and you do weak measurement. I can prove to you the same answer by looking at the von Neumann formalism. So I have a state psi, and I have a state of a measuring device, which is phi. I ask here with e to the I lambda qa, and now I assume that lambda goes to zero, very, very weak coupling. And I ask what happens under this limit of weak coupling to the state phi. And I also assume that I have a pre-selection here and a post-selection psi 2. So when I do this, I will be left with an operator that depends on Q only, and that will tell me what happened to phi if I do a pre-selection here and a post-selection here. But assuming that lambda goes to zero, I can rewrite this as psi 2, 1 plus I lambda Q times A times psi 1 times phi. And I can neglect higher order of expansion because lambda goes to zero, and this is a good expansion if lambda is sufficiently small. Now let's look at that thing here. This is equal to psi 1, psi 2 times psi 1, times 1 plus I psi 2 lambda here, psi lambda q times psi 2 a psi 1 divided by psi 2 psi 1. Because I took the psi to psi 1 outside. So this is the thing that I call weak value of A. And in this limit, this can be rewritten as e to the I lambda q times A weak. And therefore, it means that the point of the measuring device will be shifted by the value A weak. So there's a new kind of physical value, which is extremely interesting. It is going to be shown in any experiment when you do sufficiently weak measurement on each one of the particles, and it has very interesting properties. First of all, because psi 2 psi 1 can be extremely small, that thing can be a very strong amplification. For example, suppose A is a spin operator. So the maximum value of A is only 1. But when you divide by this very small number, it can give you a huge number. In fact, about 20 years ago, I published with some colleagues of mine the first article on this, where we called it, how can the result of a spin half measurement turn out to be 100? And this is the reason that the weak value can be completely outside of all the range of eigenvalues. Even more interesting, that weak value can be also complex. And the answer, the question is, how can the result of an experiment give you an imaginary number? In classical physics, it can never happen. Turns out that quantum mechanics teaches you how this can happen. Why? Because if you look at the Gaussian for the measuring device, which can be written as e to the minus pq squared over delta pq squared, or 2 here, then suppose I shift pq by an imaginary number instead of by a real number. So this will be e to the minus pq minus some imaginary number ip0 squared divided by 2 delta pq squared. Now, this is a vector that is still in the Hilbert space. You just have to normalize it because, remember that I take only partial ensemble, I have to normalize it. But this is an operator which is in the Hilbert space. And the meaning of this operator is that instead of shifting the momentum, you shift the position, the complementary variable to the point of variable. So now we have a new situation where we learn, A, that you can get in experiments results that are amplified completely outside the range of usual values, and B, that it can also give you imaginary results, so you can actually now learn that in quantum mechanics, you're allowed to put, for example, sources that are complex sources in Maxwell equation. As long as these complex sources are weak, they can shift the wave function of the fields by imaginary values. So, for example, instead of magnetic fields, it will shift the electric field, etc. Now, all the things I'm telling you now are not just theoretical wondering. There are many experiments that are now done all over the world using this kind of ideas. And I, in the time that is left, not much, but I have a few more minutes. Yes? Okay, I will tell you about some of the really interesting experiments that are being done now. And also, if I have more time, I will tell you a little bit about possible interesting generalization of quantum mechanics that are suggested by this formalism. But first, some examples of experiments that we predicted and are done now all over the world. The first experiment is the thing that I called the three-box example. I have a particle, say a charged particle, which is initially prepared in a superposition of the state psi 1 plus psi 2 plus psi 3 divided by 1 over square root of 3. So it's a particle that I prepared in a superposition of being in the three boxes. This is the initial time preparation. This is time. So at time t1, I prepare the particle in the state psi 1 plus psi 2 plus psi 3 divided by square root of 3. This is the initial state. Then I do a post-selection on the same particle, and I find it in the state psi 1 plus psi 2 minus psi 3, again divided by 1 over square root of 3. And now, I find something very interesting. If at intermediate time, I just open this box to see if the particle is there or not, I must find the particle there. Because if I don't find the particle there, I'm left just with the state psi 1 plus psi 2 plus psi 3 coming from here, and the post-selection of psi 2 minus psi 3, these are orthogonal, it can never happen. So if I do this post-selection, I must find the particle here if I open the box here. If instead I open this box, I must find, for the same reason, the particle here. There is only a single particle, so how is it possible I find it here if I open this box, or I find it here if I open that box? How is it possible? Of course, if I open both boxes and look, I will never find two particles there. The two experiments will disturb each other because they disturb the post-selection. But I know that if I open this one alone or this one alone, I will certainly find one. Now, when people usually see something like this, they say, look, you are talking about things that you have not measured. These are counterfactual. Don't speak to us about things that cannot be measured, because if you will measure here, you will disturb that. So you can't say that both of these are correct, because one measurement disturbs the other, because of the post-selection. But we have learned that we can do weak measurement experiments. What happens if I have now a large number of particles, all of them prepared in this state, and lo and behold, we find all of them finally in this state? Small probability, but it can happen. Then I can make a weak measurement and find that there are n particles here, plus minus square root of n. This is a weak measurement here that find the average number of particles here. I find that there are n particles here, plus minus square root of n. And lo and behold, I find that there are minus n here, because the total number of particles are just equal to n. What is the meaning of this minus n? The average of the projection operator here is equal to minus n, not to plus n. Remember that weak values can be completely outside the range. So even if you have things that eigenvalues are only positive, the value for the projection operator here, the sum of the projection operator is equal to minus n. The answer is not that we have a negative probability, as some people are claiming, but actually there are n particles there that have the opposite properties of the usual particles. If I measure the electric field that comes out of this box, like the Gauss flux, comes out of this box in the middle, I will find that it behaves as if there were n opposite charged particles here. If I measure the gravitational field, it will behave as if there is a negative mass here. If I measure the inertia or the pressure those particles give negative pressure. So these are particles that give opposite properties. Those things have been done. This experiment was done, in fact, here in Toronto by our first interesting experiment that came out of this. By the way, I owe you something. I did not show you that indeed sigma is per sigma y is equal to 2 when I measure weakly, what I discussed before. The answer indeed is equal to 2. Why? Because I have the following theorem. If the state psi 1 that I pre-selected is eigenvalue, is an eigen operator, an eigen function of A1, so that A1 times psi 1 is equal to alpha 1 times psi 1, and if psi 2 is an eigen vector of the operator A2, then if I look at the operator A1 plus A2 and look at the weak value of that, then it's equal to alpha 1 plus alpha 2, as you can easily check. So if I started with the state sigma x equal to plus 1 and ended up with the state sigma y equal to plus 1, and I measure weakly sigma x plus sigma y, I will get indeed the value that I say to get, which is indeed equal to 2. No question about any mark. So if I do an experiment that doesn't disturb the two vectors, I will find the impossible value that I guessed at the beginning. It's an impossible value, but that's exactly what you will find in an experiment if you do a pre and post selection on such an ensemble. Now, I speak all the time pre and post selection on ensemble, which is a very rare experiment, but in fact, you can do experiment by using for each particle an individual pointer, and then these are the experiments that are done all the time. So this is the first example, or second example, of interesting experiment. Now, let me show you two or three more interesting experiments that are being done. There are a number of experiments that have done to use the amplification that I discussed here. So suppose you send, for example, a laser beam of photons that are all moving in this direction. And suppose you put here something that does disturb them so weakly, for example, some polarizer that is so weak that it changes the direction of this by such a small angle that you cannot see it usually in the laboratory. For example, the type of angle that they show, they say that if that one experiment that was done in Rochester shifted the beam by such a small amount that they said if you take a laser beam and send the rotated beam to the moon and then look by how much it was shifted on the moon, it was shifted on the moon by something that is the width of one hair. An extremely small number. If you take this beam now and do a pre-selection here by putting some polarizer that pre-selects it in one direction, and after this very weak effect, you do another post-selection. The post-selection is nearly orthogonal direction, so that the thing is the denominator of the weak value is extremely small, then suddenly post-selects a very small part of the beam, but for this small part of the beam, you have a reflection that is much larger, so you can see it in the laboratory. And this is an extremely big advantage because you can show that although the total number of particles that you need in the laser, total number of photons, is the same that you will need anyhow to overcome the ratio between the signal and the noise, by post-selecting that very small amount, you can show that any non-statistical disturbance, which usually happens for such small effects, will not affect the weak measurement, but it will affect the usual measurement. So these are extremely useful techniques for measuring extremely small effects. Now, one other experiment was done is connected to something that was predicted by Lucille Hardy, which here, who predicted a very interesting effect. And let me show you what it is, and that will be the last example of this kind. Although there are many more interesting things, but what did Hardy suggest? It is related to something that first was predicted by two of my students, former students who are now professors, Avi Elitzur and Lev Weidman. They said the following. Suppose I look at a Mach Zender, I send here a photon, and I have here a mirror, here a mirror, here half-reflecting mirror, and here a half-reflecting mirror. So the photon comes here, it splits into two halves, one going here and another going here, and then it recombines, and the optical lengths are unknown, then it will come, say, this photon will always come in this direction. Now they said, suppose we put here something to make it extremely exciting, we put here a bomb. This bomb is so gentle that if a single photon touches it, it immediately explodes. Okay? The question is, can we find whether the bomb was placed here or not without at all touching it? So suppose somebody can either put the bomb here or not put it here. Usually, if we want to see if it's here or not, we should come and look whether it's there or not, and then we'll immediately explode it. But they say, no, look. If the bomb is here, we know that if it did not explode, the photon must have gone in this way. If it went this way, then it has already a probability to go also in this direction. So if we send the photon here and we see it coming here in this direction, we know that something must have disturbed it, and the only thing that could disturb it is the bomb. So we have found out that the bomb is here, even though the photon was never close to it. And in fact, people improved this interaction-free measurement. Here it's only successful with probability 1/2, but you can show that you can make this probability as close to 1 as you like. So it's close to 1, this probability is close to 1. You can actually measure whether something is here without touching it at all. Actually, the photon was never close to it, because if it went this way, it would explode the bomb. Now came Harvey, Lucille, and say something extremely interesting, variation of that thing. He said, instead of a bomb, I will do something else. I will take two Mach Zender. On one of them, I will send here an electron, and the other, I will send here a positron. See? Positron. And I will do it in such a way they will spend some time here, or anyhow, this Gedanken experiment. If this one went here and this one went there, I will arrange that they will actually annihilate each other. So if they don't annihilate each other, then I know that I can calculate and show that although without the positron, the electron must always have gone this way, with the positron, it can sometimes come in this way. And similarly, the positron that always has to come this way now can come sometimes this way. So suppose I see the positron coming here and the electron coming here. I say, okay, each one of them measures the fact that the other one went into the closed orbit. Because the electron says, look, I came here only because the positron disturbed me. Because if the positron did not disturb me, I would always go this way. So only if the positron went this way, the electron can end up here. But similarly, the positron ended up here is only because the electron must have gone this way. So now if I observe both these things, I now come to an impossible situation. I know for sure the positron went this way, I know for sure that the electron went this way, but I know for sure also that they never were together. How is it possible? What is the usual answer? The usual answer is to say, look, you're talking about counterfactual experiments, experiments that you have not done. You're not supposed to talk about something like this. There was a very well-known physicist by the name of Asher Peres, who died, unfortunately, a few years ago in Israel. And he said, I want on my tomb to be the statement, when they bury me, there will be the statement, unobserved quantities, unobserved things don't have values. Don't speak about things that you have measured. So, for example, if you indeed go and measure whether the positron is here, if you find the electron going this way, you will always find it here. But if you find it here, the reason why it ended up here is not anymore because the electron was here, it is because of your disturbance. So therefore, there is no paradox. Once you talk about actual experiments, there is no surprise. But now come again the idea of weak measurement. The idea of weak measurement, say, look, I can actually weakly measure whether the positron went this way, and we find it definitely for sure that it went this way. So also the electron went this way. Maybe they were never together. How is it possible? And the answer is very interesting. Quantum mechanics teaches that. How to think in a new way about possibilities of measurement. If you think about pairs, electron pair and a positron pair, there are four possible pairs. Let's call this orbit 1 and 2, and this 3 and 4. There is one pair when the electron, the positron went in orbit 1, and the electron went in orbit 3, so it's a pair N1C. We know for sure that this pair is equal to 0, because they never annihilated each other. There is another pair where the positron went here, and the electron went here. This is N1-4. N1-4 must be equal to 1. There must be a pair like this because of this sum is equal, what is the number of times that the positron went here? And we know that for sure it went there. Similarly, if we look at N2-3, we must also get the value 1 because the electron for sure went here. And N2-3 plus N1-3 is the number of times the electron went here. But now already we have two pairs, although altogether we have one pair. So it must mean that N1-4 must be equal to minus 1. What does it mean that that pair is equal to minus 1? It means that if you look at that interaction, you suppose N2-4 must be equal to minus 1. So the number, this is the probability to find the electron and the positron in box 2 and 4. So suppose I bring these two boxes in the middle and look quickly at the interaction between them, that interaction which is proportional to this number will be, instead of attractive, it will be repulsive. This experiment was done, an analogous experiment to this was done also in two different locations, here in Toronto by the same group that I mentioned before, and also by a group in Japan. They've shown something analogous that is done with photons. With two photons, they were able to show that indeed this negative value is observable there. Now, I'll just mention briefly two other experiments that were just reported months ago, a few weeks ago. One of them has shown that it's possible to measure the wave function of a quantum system by using weak measurements. And the other experiment, again, done by Ephraim, that shows that it's possible, in a two-slit interference, it's possible to show the interference property exists, and nevertheless, to show through which slit the particle went, something that people always thought is impossible. Now, I just mentioned very briefly generalization of quantum mechanics that are suggested for me. One of them is a very nice and simple solution to the problem of the collapse. You know that if you look at the prediction of quantum mechanics for measurement theory, it tells you only that you have possible different answers, and all of them coexist. And then people invented, Everett was the first one, invented the idea of many worlds. Many worlds means that when you look at the possible results of quantum experiments, your brain splits into remembering one thing or another thing, and all of them exist. They don't know of each other, so there is no collapse at all. But that interpretation is extremely ugly in the sense that, first of all, it leads to practically infinite number of branches that you never know that they exist. Second, it's very difficult to explain the probability in this way, and it's unbelievable that you have to go through this complexity in order to solve the problem of the collapse. On the other hand, if you look at the idea that the quantum system is described by two vectors instead of one, then you can show that you can put boundary conditions on the universe in such a way that out of all the branches that come out, only one of them will be post-selected, and that will be a vector that comes back from the future and tells you what actual result did happen in quantum measurement. So this is a possible answer to the problem of the collapse by using pre- and post-selection for the universe, for the whole universe. Another interesting possibility is to say that really there are cosmological consequences if you look at possibilities that there are two boundary conditions for the universe instead of one. You know that people find, for example, now that you may perhaps have to use the anthropic principle in order to select a particular solution for example, the string problem, right? I'm saying that you can replace the anthropic property by post-selection, cosmological post-selection, and it will be much more useful because then you can get some other prediction of it, while from the anthropic principle, you just have to expect everything that you get. And finally, there are interesting generalization of dynamics that I don't have time to discuss now that use the two vectors and that leads to a new kind of complementarity between kinematics and dynamics, but I'm sorry I don't have time to talk about it now. I'm still open for a number of questions if anyone has questions. Thank you.
Questions?
Well, I'm glad that you accept everything.
Thank you. Previously, you mentioned that when you had this minus
n... Can you speak louder? I can't hear you.
When you had this minus n with experiment, and you said you could have a negative mass and negative charge, what does it physically mean? I mean, you don't really have a particle that has... You don't have a system that has negative mass, do you? So when you prepared your...
The three boxes example?
No, previously, when you had this first experiment, you had the system in phi 1 plus phi 2 plus phi 3, and you had the three boxes. And you looked at one of the box, and then the other box, and the third box. And you said that...
I said that I must find it there or there, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
So what's the question? Why did I say it?
Sorry?
Why did I say that I must find it there?
No.
The question is, what is the interpretation of the negative number?
No, I'm just saying that, remember, in the three boxes, I know for sure that if I open one of them, I will find the particle there. Mm-hmm. That means that the weak value for the projection operator must also be one. And the weak value for the projection operator on the second box must be one. The weak value for the sum of the three projections must be one, and therefore the weak value of the large, the final projection operator is minus one. And because it's minus one, that means that if you look at all properties that are measured weakly, like the total field or the total gravitational field or the total inertia, these are all proportional to the projection operator. So if it's the opposite value, it means that those are particles, but we have like particles have the opposite properties of the normal particles. I haven't decided yet how to call this particle. Perhaps I will use the name teleparticle from teleology for things that has to do with things that come back from the future. But these are rich properties of quantum systems that are being post-selected that you will never guess if you just look at the usual formalism.
So have particles like that been found? Or?
Sorry?
So have you experimentally found particles that have these negative properties?
Yeah. Maybe I should explain one more thing that I did not have time to explain. How is it possible that I get in the middle this strange value? When I do an experiment in the middle, I get this strange value of electric field in the opposite direction because later I have to do this post-selection. Suppose later I do a different post-selection that actually measure where the particle is. So how do I explain the result that I get in the middle? The answer is the result I get in the middle could also be due to a mistake. The measuring device must also have uncertainties in each pointer, and then I will interpret those results as mistakes. So there is the uncertainty principle tells you the following thing. A, that you can do a post-selection because the future is not definite, and B, that the measuring device must have also, when you do weak measurement, fails that give you uncertain results, but if you do the proper post-selection, out of this noise of the measuring device comes a new reality, which are the things that is described by weak values. So weak values are a way to put order into quantum noise in the middle. And if you do the proper post-selection, you will suddenly see that out of this noise in the middle comes a new reality. And that's the thing that is new in here, that cannot happen classically. So that's how the future looks like it affects the present because it puts order in noises, otherwise you would not see this order at all. Another question?
And on the same subject, when you're talking about these particles with negative properties,
I can't hear you. Sorry, my ear.
Sorry, I'm asking on the same subject when you're trying to interpret these particles that have these negative properties.
Yes.
My question is, to detect these, can you detect these with normal measurements or do you only?
Can you say again? Can you tell me what the question is?
Can you detect these negative properties using normal measurements, or can you only detect them using weak measurements?
I have to apologize, I could not hear the question.
So the question is, when you have these negative numbers, can you detect these properties using normal measurements or only using weak measurements?
No, it's only weak measurements. In a strong normal measurement, you will never see them. It's only properties of weak measurement.
Thank you.
Only because, remember, in strong measurement, we always disturb the two vectors. So, as I said, you could never see this value sigma h plus sigma y equal to 2 because you must, in any normal experiment, you must disturb at least one of them. So you must look gently at the quantum system to see it in vivo, to see its real properties. This is the thing that was missed, that if you look gently at the quantum system weakly, then you suddenly see a new reality that is not there. If you only look strongly and disturb everything, you kill the system, so to say. Yes.
Oh, yes, so you argued that in several situations having two states is better than having just one. So following the same thread, it is kind of easy to imagine situations where we have sequences of measurements, and one could wonder whether having more than two states is better. Can you comment on this?
Can you say clearly what you asked? Yeah.
Okay. I guess simply, could it be the case that you should have, in some situations, more than two states,
if you have many possible eigenvalues, yes. So what's the question?
No, if having many times instead of just two times could be useful in
many
some
times?
Yeah.
No, because if you do, if this is time, if you do a strong experiment here to measure psi 1, that strong experiment destroys all the information that came from the past because that experiment destroyed all this information. So a strong experiment here that defines the single state erases all the information that came from the past. Doesn't matter what state came from the past. If this experiment is complete, all the memory from the past is lost. Similarly here, if we measure psi 2, all the information that comes from later future will be destroyed by this experiment. So therefore, two strong experiments are completely the maximum boundary condition you can put on a quantum system. Then in between, if you do weak measurement, you will check this. If you do a strong measurement, you will create another boundary condition. But I'm thinking about two strong experiments here and here, and then weak measurements here that check the properties of these two strong boundary conditions. So there is not more than two boundary conditions you can put on a quantum system.
As long as they are strong.
Huh?
As long as they are strong.
Okay? Yes. If it's partial experiment, then you can do more experiments. But I'm talking about full experiment that don't leave any degeneracy. So a full experiment just gives you two boundary conditions, no more, no less.
Okay, I think probably we should finish there. And Jaakko, you're around just for the rest of today, I guess. Yeah.
Yes.
Let's thank Professor Aharonov once more.